You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hi, this is Meg Riley. Ah, it's the Hulk.
Smash.
Hank, did you want a little attention? Hank Pearce has not been with us for a few weeks. You've been off doing, what have you been doing? Why don't you introduce yourself first, since you want attention today?
You know, well, that was kind of crazy. Church startup stuff and running around and getting that stuff and trying to get my mind in, like, church mode. You know, church mind. You know what it's like, church mind. But life is great. I'm really, really good. And sorry to jump in.
Is the Hulk related to church mind? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, our lovely sister Joanna sent it to me. It appeared in my mailbox this week.
For some reason, thought of Hank. Can't think of why.
Joanna, why don't you introduce yourself?
I am Joanna Fontaine Crawford, and I am here in Austin. Isn't that supposedly like fall started today, but not here, not for another 4 months.
Hot. It's hot there. Yeah. Aisha Hauser.
Hi, I am Aisha, as you just said, in Seattle, and it's bright and sunny. It has been bright and sunny mostly the entire 2 years I've been here, so I'm not, yeah, I guess climate change has hit Seattle because it is not nearly as rainy as anyone led us to believe.
Oh, there you go. And Meg Riley in St. Paul today, not Minneapolis, the twin city, where it is Seattle weather. It's rainy, overcast, you know, that kind of thing. So what's new where you are? Aisha, how's your kid doing in school?
Well, it's very interesting because this school has a reputation. It's been around since the 70s for only for troubled kids. And in fact, one of my son's teachers last year told him not to go. And so I sent him a very strongly worded email that I am his mother and know what's best for him. So, because I had investigated the school and was very impressed with it. So here are his classes this year: Immersion Russian, Utopia Dystopia, Skateboarding and Dodgeball, along with Algebra and the History of Food. So a really eclectic mix, and I'm very impressed. So I can't wait to see how soon it is before he starts asking for things in Russian. And he's very happy, which makes me happy because he has not loved school. School is not made for my son. It's made for my daughter, who's a rule-following introvert. It is not made for extroverts who are free thinkers. So I'm very grateful.
It's also not made for introverts who are free thinkers, I will say.
For any free thinker.
Yeah. My own 19-year-old has gone from a total hippie high school to, a university with a ton of structure. And it's not... we'll see. This is my new parenting mantra, which I commend to parents of older teens. You just do this.
That's so hard for me because Egyptians have no boundaries. And so I think that this is what I'm supposed to be doing, but thousands of years of culture.
Your kids aren't that old yet either, right?
No. My daughter's 17. She's a senior.
No. Not till they're legally adults do you have to do that.
We'll see. Okay, I'll try.
A Jewish friend said the same thing to me. She's like, Jewish mothers just don't do it that way.
Exactly.
But I'm working on it. It's not so easy for me either, though I don't have ancestry to claim. It's just my own controlling nature. Oh, goodness. Hank, your kids are little. They still adore you, right?
Yes. Why wouldn't they? Don't all parents give them a few years?
Give them a few.
What?
Years.
Huh? I don't know. No. I get to be like awesome guy. No, I'm. You know. Yeah. This morning we were talking about what I will be wearing for Halloween, which is. They said, "What will you go as?" I said, "Yes, your dad." And they said, "No, you have to wear a costume." You know. I don't know. But life, you know, life is good. So I'm happy.
That's a good thing. Joanna looks like she might be having scream therapy. She's frozen in it, whatever.
Am I frozen?
Oh, there you are. Now you moved. You were kind of like one of those faces your mother says, don't make that face or you'll freeze, you know, on my screen.
I made that face. What happens.
How's it going with you, Joanna? You got a pass of kids down there. How are they doing?
Yeah, they are all doing good. And oh my gosh, my son, who is now a sophomore in college, I'm here to tell you, those who are going through a rough time in the teen years, it gets better. It really does. It's so cool seeing them become, you know, adults, and like you want to hang out with them and talk with them.
Awesome. It's like an It Gets Better campaign for parents.
I absolutely think that's needed, especially those in the teenage years, and then those when your kid is like 2 and 3, and you know, well, heck, or when they're babies and you're just like, I'm never going to be able to sleep again. It gets better. Trust me.
It's all a phase. It's all a phase. That's what you were saying. It's all a phase. The good stuff, even the good stuff, it's a phase.
Yeah, that's the truth. That is the truth. Well, we have special guests today. We're working out a few technical difficulties.
The Pope is coming onto our call now. We're wiremen.
The Pope feels that we would be more influential than Congress to talk to, so he would like to be here with us. I am hoping and praying that Pope really calls out Congress on some of the stuff he does well. People keep writing to me telling me things he doesn't do well, as if I don't know that, as if you either have to love a pope completely or hate a pope totally. They're either good or bad. I say this pope has done some real good, and if he talks about climate change and economic justice to Congress, more power to him.
See, now, wouldn't it be cool if, like, he went in there with, you know, a whip and started turning over the tables, and that would be impressive.
Just one second.
Oh, we've lost Meg.
That would be good. It was funny. I turned on a little bit of it just now. I turned on a bit of the Pope just now, and I watched. And you know, so I missed like the beginning of it, and really just came in for a little bit. And all I saw, and this is a total clergy like thing, was that he took his page and then he turned it like that. And I thought to myself, that's not how you preach. You got to slide it across so they don't realize that you're reading from a piece of paper, man. You got to slide it across, you know. Busman's holiday. I'm criticizing the Pope next, you know.
You're criticizing the Pope, who does not have English as his first language, and I believe, therefore, totally, can be known to be reading, really, without critique. Well, Leslie has showed up with, hopefully you can hear us, Leslie. Is that?
I can hear you. Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, good.
And I can too.
Oh, you can, Carlton. You can hear us now, but we can't see you anymore.
Oh, dang it. Well, let's see what we can do about that. I tell you, these modern technologies.
I know. I'm very excited today. We have two of the leaders of this new emerging group, Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism, that have been sending out principles and really giving us all a great opportunity to learn. So I'm very excited about our guests today. And not only today, but they have agreed to come on every month and tell us what's new, which I'm especially excited. I've been calling it the Blue View. You know, like there's that old show, Blue's Clues. So we'll have the Blue View. Carlton, you're there.
Yay.
So who wants to start? Leslie, why don't you tell us, what is Black Lives of UU? Where did it come from, and how did you get organized?
Sure. So Black Lives of
UU. Wait a minute. I didn't introduce you. I'm so sorry. This is Leslie McFadyen, who has recently moved to, I'm not quite sure
Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Grand Rapids, Michigan, and is a fabulous organizer. I always love seeing that you know all these people I know in Minneapolis who are not Unitarian Universalists, who are racial justice activists, and I'm like, she knows everybody. So anyway, fabulous for you to be here. And Carlton Elliott Smith, who is in Mississippi now, having been part of the Great Migration the other way, going back home. And so he is, what's your title at the UUA, Carlton?
I am one of 7 congregational life staff serving the UUA Southern region, which stretches all the way from Texas and Oklahoma on the west to Florida and Southern Virginia on the east.
That's a diverse area. So the two of them are here to talk to us about this new movement. So, Leslie, why don't you start?
Sure, absolutely. So Black Lives of UU came about as a, I wouldn't say byproduct, but certainly a result of the Movement for Black Lives convening, which took place in Cleveland July 24th through 26th, where about 1,500 black folks from all over the country got together, even some from outside of this country, got together to build and learn and heal and organize together. So lots of black Unitarian Universalists took up the call and made the trek out to Cleveland from all over the country to join in this gathering. And we collectively kind of took this rare opportunity of all of us being in one place to do our best to meet with each other as much as we possibly could, fit into a very packed weekend that was already in place. And I was working the whole weekend, so for me it was particularly challenging to find time, but we were able to squeeze in some time during meals in particular to get together and interact. And so one of one lunch that we all met up, a bunch of us, I think it was seven of us at that point, we really were talking about some of the unique issues we've been facing as Black UUs and the commonalities that we had been seeing in our lives, in the lives of other Black UUs, and in our congregations, or should I say former congregations in a lot of instances. And so out of that conversation kind of came this unifying call, which is that we see the fight for Black liberation and collective liberation directly tied to our UU principles. And so the conversation sort of evolved from there into this idea of putting together a set of principles that would connect the Movement for Black Lives with the principles that we all adhere to and certainly believe in as Unitarian Universalists. And so that was kind of the spark and ember that started in Cleveland and allowed us to have some organizing muscle and content to move forward with each other. And
so the reports that I saw coming out of Cleveland on Facebook, you know, were just ecstatic almost of the people who were there that I knew, Unitarian Universalists and otherwise, feeling so affirmed, and seemed like there was a real focus on self-care and self-love, and people just seemed transformed by that event.
Yeah, I would say for sure that was the case. It was very powerful for those of us who were able to be there. I should also mention that it was the case that for a number of us, myself included, our participation as Black Unitarian Universalists at the Movement for Black Lives convening was supported financially by our larger Unitarian Universalist Association. So you know, want to acknowledge and affirm that as well. There was never an occasion where all the Unitarian Universalists were in the same room at the same time, or at least not all together in the same room, because there were probably, I don't know, 14 or 15 of us all together. But, you know, as Leslie said, it was great to have that chance to get together on those occasions when we did. There was a Friday evening gathering at dinner. As Leslie mentioned, we got together for lunch on Sunday and then breakfast on lunch on Saturday and breakfast on Sunday. And the other thing that can't go understated is Leslie's involvement in organizing the Movement for Black Lives convening. She managed all the registration, I believe, and the volunteer coordination and training. And,
I didn't know that. My gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing. And Alandria Williams, who was also deeply involved, she was the one who was, I think she headed up the safety team. That's correct, Leslie?
That is correct, yep.
She did an amazing job, and we'll get to like some of the things that happened, but it was her involvement was critical in some of the negotiations that had to happen with the Cleveland Police Department, just in terms of making sure that everyone was safe and we got the outcome that we wanted when there was a brush with the law at the tail end of the convening. So we can come back around to that.
Yeah, let's get to that in a minute. But Leslie, that's amazing. I didn't realize you were in that role. I've heard that it was really organized in a really unique way that I wish sometimes some UU events maybe could take some notes from. It seemed like it was a very interactive way of choosing what was presented. And can you talk a little bit about that conference? Because I just wonder how much the creativity and experimentation and how well that works actually is part of what you're reflecting in the principles that I've been looking at.
definitely is. I mean, for me, I've been an event planner and organizer for, you know, more than a decade. So I have a lot of experience in that arena. But this was a really unique experience for me as an organizer and an event planner for a lot of different reasons. The first being that the center of the planning process was really in terms of interaction for those that were going to be there. And I mean, that starts with the first thing we discussed as an organizing team was what barriers would be in place for people to attend. And so all of our planning started from making sure those barriers were not there for people to come. And that was a really important thing and a really different place to kind of do this planning and work from. And then secondly, just a place of Black love. I mean, we really wanted as a team for everyone to come and feel affirmed and feel love and feel that we were trying to create a really unique space, one that has never been created in our generation before, for Black folks to get together and build together and have time to heal and really what that would look like. And so, yeah, there were a lot of interactive pieces, one in that people got to vote on submitted sessions, and that helped shape the program. Again, the whole barriers issue, you know, we had a sliding scale with regard to cost of attending, a sliding scale for cost of housing as well, going all the way down to nothing so that people that just were financially unable to give anything were able to still come. I think we had just an internal motto, you know, if you're Black and you want to get free, you're welcome. And we would make sure that you got there somehow. Transportation was another key thing. We had to coordinate with lots of different cities, and that was a big piece as well. So there was a lot that went into that and what that would look like. And then, you know, creating the different spaces and making sure that we were, on the one hand, very flexible to allow things to play out as they needed to during the convening, but also to have enough structure so that people were really able to get meaningful use out of the work that they were doing and time they were spending. So, you know, it was a lot of work, but it was the most incredible experience that I've had as an organizer. And I was just saying that I'll be back in New York next week, actually meeting with the team again to do our recap and talking about what we're going to be doing going forward. So, yeah,
that's very exciting, and I feel vicarious pride as Carlton's sharing the role that Unitarian Universalists had in making that event work. And so one of the leading thing that this Principles Project has said is it's because of our Unitarian Universalist values that we proclaim that Black Lives Matter. So before we get into the principles and all of them, let's just talk about that statement. That's a huge thing to say, and I'd love to hear both of you speak to that.
I'll let Carlton go first.
On Black Lives and our Unitarian Universalist principles, well, I think I'm amongst those Unitarian Universalists who came into the movement based on the principles. I read the principles at a service that was being led by Alma Crawford, whom I think is also on the call, back when I was just in seminary back in the early 90s. And it's like, well, this is more than anything else that I read. This is what I actually believe. And so I think for myself and I'd say other Black Unitarian Universalists, we're solid on the principles. It's sometimes how they get expressed or do not get expressed in the context of, you know, our larger UUA and local congregations that can be like a painful thing. And so what the question was is like, how can we build a bridge, you know, and make the link and the connection between our Unitarian Universalist principles and Black Lives Matter? And for the Movement for Black Lives convening, there was a list of guiding principles that Leslie was instrumental in working on. And I guess our Unitarian Universalist values were imbued into that with her participation for sure. But, you know, looking at those and sort of putting them next to our Unitarian Universalist principles, we started seeing like these, with this correlation, these relationships. And it was out of that that we had this idea. And I guess I would say that as Unitarian Universalists, if we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person and justice, equity, and compassion in human relations and encouragement of one another to spiritual growth, all of these things that we proclaim, and if we acknowledge that in the context of global anti-Blackness, the sentiment that pushes against or denounces or invalidates Black people in cultures around the globe, if we can affirm the inherent worth and dignity of Black lives, that is already a long way on the step to making sure everybody has their rights protected, because if there are people who are denied that, and we've seen it time and time again over the course of the past several years, with the advent of more video cameras, that these things are actually being documented, we can't take the inherent worth and dignity of Black lives for granted, because we don't live in a culture that shares that value. So we're trying to push that out as well into the wider culture and into our larger association.
Yeah, I mean, everything Carlton said, really, he said it pretty well. I think, you know, it's something that I've been, you know, I've tweeted and I've put on Facebook about just this connection between the Movement for Black Lives and Black liberation and my Unitarian Universalist faith. And so for me, it was a real kind of seeing those principles lived out in a Black space at the convening that really drove it home. And so that's why I felt really strongly that this was the time to gather us together as Black Unitarians, Universalists, and discuss making this real connection between that and what that would look like. And so for me, the Seven Principles of Black Lives was an attempt to give context to the work that we do towards Black liberation as Black UUs. And that's what we set out to do in terms of putting them together collectively, and also how we just chose to roll them out and make them available to the wider public.
And so are the people working on this, was it everyone from Cleveland? Is it a bigger group? Are you, how are, I don't mean to jump into the future too much, but I'm, and I do want to get back to the principles, but how are you envisioning, or are you just, one of the principles is to let it emerge, I know, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I think that we certainly have people that are stepping up to take the lead. Carlton, myself, Lena Gardner, Kenny Wiley, I'd say the four of us have been pretty, you know, in the forefront in terms of organizing everything and making information available, but it's definitely a collaborative space. And so what we try to do is allow people to put together content and make that available to a small group of us that have gathered together, I think about 30 at this point, and make content available for comment and concern and collaboration. And from there, we would then make it available to the public. And that's a general cycle of all the content that you've seen, whether it was the statement about Black Lives signage, and also all of the principles. So it's a leaderful a movement, just like the Movement for Black Lives, but certainly a collaborative one as well.
Yeah, Leslie just said, I so appreciate that aspect and that spirit of it, and actually trying to provide a context where there are additional voices being heard that we haven't heard before. We're talking about it just the other day amongst ourselves, that the typical model of the way that Black people are related to, not just in Unitarian Universalism, but in other associations as well, is that one or two people, two if you're lucky, get identified as the go-to person for, you know, issues pertaining to Black people. And what we are acknowledging and affirming, that we've got like a whole spectrum of people who've got concerns about their relationship to Unitarian Universalists, parents with children, people who are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. I mean, it's just a whole spectrum of people who are members of other religious movements who still have some relationship to Unitarian Universalism. And so we're trying to create a space and an atmosphere for those variety of voices to be heard. And as I was saying to some of the folks that were on a Black Lives UU call the other night, I've got a friend of mine who is not Unitarian Universalist, never been to a sermon, you know, that I've given or anything like that. But when those seven principles of Black lives hit, he wanted to be sure to get all of them and not miss any of them, because he found them affirming and helpful. So that's to say that, you know, we're reaching even beyond our traditional UU circles and actually creating another port of entry for people who might be in sympathy with our larger Unitarian Universalist values through Black Lives UU.
That's great. What is your hope and wish that bricks and mortar congregations would do with those principles?
I would say it would be great if we had ongoing engagement with them. What we are looking to do now that we've had the initial rollout of them is, over the course of the next 8 months, not including the month of December, starting from October, is to take for our congregations to look at the principles in sequence. So, October will be one, November will be two, going forward like that, such that there'll be engagement with those principles, people reflecting on how it affects their lives, whether they're Black Unitarian Universalist or not. So I think there's going to be these ongoing opportunities for engagement, for people to see like what it has to do with them. And we've had some rigorous conversations online already, with people who are Black Unitarian Universalists as well as the people who are not. And it's interesting to see the different opinions that surface. Of course, there's folks who are saying that, well, all lives matter. And so there's that kind of debate that's going back and forth. And we're saying we'll continue to affirm that all Black lives matter, not to the exclusion that all lives matter, but the fact that we have to keep reaffirming the importance of Black lives is already indicative of the challenges that we face.
Well, let's pause right there, because that the violence of the defacing of the signage, it continues. I just saw you in today. It's not just a hey, all lives matter. It's like ah! I mean, it's a the rage that's behind that statement is violent. I mean, the cutting and the slashing and the covering and the eliminating and erasing and have you seen that? I've wondered if the All Lives Matter people, kind of some of them, the UUs go, oh, well, gosh, I didn't mean that. I mean, if that signage is engaging people who otherwise maybe would just stick with their All Lives Matter rhetoric. I don't know. I feel like, Aisha, don't control your face. Come on in here.
Aisha.
You know, so the Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, I get upset when at the violence of the signs. The part that actually just I struggle with more is when I hear white UUs start saying, oh no, but all lives matter. And that to me is actually a more challenging and frustrating conversation, because the part of me that's not an adult religious educator wants to start facepalming people and say, you know better, stop it. Like, you know, you're not a white supremacist. I'm going to believe that about you. Stop it. You're a UU. So we need to start from the same page. And so it is terrible and it is violent and it is awful, the people that are defacing the signs. And I am going to assume they are not Unitarian Universalists. They are people that are already, the Confederate flag, gun owners, whatever. But the thing that I'd like to, lift up is the difficult conversations among our own community. UUs, well-meaning, who say, who really genuinely struggle with the movement Black Lives Matter, because I don't think it's just a phrase. Somebody put, who's not a UU, a friend of mine, who said, I'm I don't like the phrase Black Lives Matter. And I said, it's not a phrase, it's a movement. It is an appeal to our better selves. It is a call to action. So that's what went through my head when I was rolling my eyes.
Hmm. Yeah. Jake Morrell just wrote a really powerful piece for the Oak Ridge newspaper. He's the minister of our congregation in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And he said like that often, he realizes that for some people, when they see the Black Lives Matter, they think they read it as saying only Black Lives Matter. And he says it's better to read it Black Lives Matter too. But Jake has had, they had Black Lives Matter on there. They have a light up a signboard out front that will say potluck supper Saturday and Black Lives Matter and other things going on, and they've gotten lots of pushback. A whole rally, a Police Lives Matter rally, started sort of in response to his church's signage. And I won't speak for him. He has some amazing stories from that. And his biggest thing was sort of going that he went to this rally, this Police Lives Rally to meet folks, to interact with them, to hand out his business card, to invite folks to come and meet him, to have coffee. I know that his congregation had put forward the idea of providing cool drinks for folks at the rally, which I thought was just, you know, a really wonderful way of not meeting one hard stance with another hard stance. It was it's an amazing thing, and very brave, and of course you see this pushback everywhere, you know, in our congregations and the communities of our congregations all around the country, not just in the South. We certainly shouldn't think that racism is something that only happens in one particular region of our country.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I would caution to necessarily assume that these thoughts and disturbing behavior is not necessarily in our congregations as well. I think that, unfortunately, you know, we have to put forth the possibility that it's there. I think often for Unitarian Universalists, we tend to think that issues related to racial injustice are outward issues. And so what this movement has brought home for a lot of us is that that's not the case at all. And we really do need to look closer to home to address these things within our congregations and within our faith. And that's also a big reason why Black Lives of UU came about.
Yeah, and I wanted to just add like a couple of points. Oak Ridge is a very interesting case, especially because Oak Ridge as a city was established during the Second World War as a secret city while they were working on atomic bombs there. And was established as one of the conditions for coming to Tennessee was that it was going to be a segregated city. So they actually set up like a whole separate like black section in Oak Ridge. So that's not ironic. I mean, there's ways in which I would say our Unitarian Universalist congregation has benefited from that. I mean, to the extent that in the same way that congregations all over the country have benefited from, UU congregations all over the country have benefited from segregated housing because that allows for a certain cohesion. Why I affirm, continue to affirm that whiteness is part of the glue that holds our association together. So all of that needs to be paid attention to. The other thing that comes to mind for me is with the destruction of the destruction, removal, disappearance of the signage. It's like, okay, I hope people are getting, it's like if people are having that kind of reactivity around a sign in front of a church, you know, what is it like for those of us who are walking around day to day in black skins, you know? So I think it's brilliant. I think it's a real opportunity for people to get it, just a little glimmer, you know, of what anti-blackness, you know, means on a day-to-day level, and then having a, you know, personal experience, like a personal attack, like some of us experience, you know, pretty much every day.
Amen to that. I've been part of a campaign that Showing Up for Racial Justice, which is a white allies group, has been doing, going door to door, asking, especially white people, but whoever answers the door, if they want a Black Lives Matter sign to put in their yard. Which we're doing in relationship with Black Lives Matter Minneapolis. And we're targeting a particular ward with a particular city councilor. And the white people are mostly, even if they're like, yeah, I'm totally with you, they're like, but I don't know what my neighbors would think, and it's really, you know, blah, 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 blah. And the people of color are like, right over there by the flower garden, you know, like, and I'm like, it's more vulnerable on this block, you know, like,
yeah.
Just really different senses of what safety looks like and what danger looks like, and I think we have such conversations to be had about that. I'm preaching on that this Sunday in Wisconsin, where they're engaged with the police chief about their sign, and you know, these signs seemed, at the first I was like, signs, but now I'm like, you know what, this is a really important thing, these signs. So I really appreciated the statement that the collective made about the signs. Is there anything else you want to lift up from that statement or about that, how you decided to do that?
And as a matter of fact, could you talk a bit more about that? Because I want to make sure that everybody is up to speed and understands all that, and also where they can find all of this information too.
Leslie, did you want
to? Sure. Well, as far as where to find it, you can go to Black Lives of UU on Facebook. We have a forward-facing Facebook group. You can also go to @BlackLivesUU on Twitter, and you can find links to it there. We have a Medium account Medium at Black Lives UU. You can see all of the statements that we've put forth thus far, including the one about signage. And I think that I'll let Carlton talk about the details of this particular statement, but the idea of statements themselves from the collective is one that you'll see a lot more of moving forward, because there has definitely been a void of voice of Black UUs in our faith. And so what we want to do is, as Carlton said, is give voice to our needs, our concerns, and our feelings about a lot of issues that affect us, not just as Black people, but specifically as Black UUs. And so this was just the first of many statements to come. We have a long list of topics that we all have felt needed some addressing, and so the collective will be, you know, drafting and collaborating and putting together lots of different statements. But this one came about because obviously I'm sure lots of people know about the situation at Beverly Unitarian in Chicago. And so that, coupled with, as we've all been talking about, so much vandalization of Black Lives Matter signage at UU congregations, it just seemed like a good time for us to kind of let people know what we as Black UUs have been thinking. When we have a faith that is, as we all know, so centered in whiteness and Eurocentric, often it's easy to center all of the feelings about different issues on those same things. And so what we hope to do with the statement was to center this situation and the statement in the lives of Black people so that the wider faith knows how we have been feeling, what we have been thinking. And so that's kind of where this sentiment came from. I'll let Carlton take over the content of it, because he was a big force behind the actual words that you saw. So I'll turn it over to him.
What I can say about that is that while there was this particular situation with this particular congregation that was somewhat alarming for those of us, and a feeling like there was a possibility for people who, having made the commitment to stand with Black Lives Matter and then starting to feel the heat of anti-Blackness coming in their direction, started to back away from it. We wanted to create something that actually affirmed continued engagement with the issue. So that's how it came about. And I think, you know, the thought was, rather than taking it as, you know, an opportunity to really offer up, you know, additional criticism to any particular congregation that had already been, you know, raked over the coals in its local community and then, you know, further afield as well through social media, take it as an opportunity to lift up all of those other so many of the congregations who, when their sign was cut up or the Black was cut out of it or it disappeared or got burned or like whatever happened to it, to say to them, it's like, thank you, and show our appreciation for them being willing to come up with alternative responses rather than to retreat, to say, oh, we're going to do a bigger sign. Oh, we're going to keep putting signs back up as long as they keep taking them down. It's just an underscoring just how important and valuable it is to continue to stand in solidarity. So that was really the thinking about it. And also offering hope to those congregations and those congregations who might be feeling the heat and wanting to take a step back, encouraging them to be in communication with other congregations that are similarly standing and making those connections, and to ask questions of themselves about, like, how taking down a sign or coming up with alternative language doesn't support the larger movement for Black lives and isn't even really consistent with our own Unitarian Universalist forebears like Viola Liuzzo and James Reeb, who lost their white lives in the struggle for Black lives. So those are some of the ideas that went into that. And hopefully, you know, I think some people took it as, got one response from somebody who said that we were race baiting and people were going to say what they have to say about that. But certainly the intention was one of acknowledging what binds us together, could bind us together, even when we're faced with adversity.
I thought it was a beautiful statement of faith, just for an alternate view on it.
Now, one thing I'll mention, too, is that I will say that one of the sentiments that I've heard consistently from white UUs is that, you know, this notion of being sick of talking about race, that talking about race is the problem, that we shouldn't be focused on these issues surrounding race. And so I think that's a really important point that Carlton made, because it's something that we see as Black UUs in our faith life. I know that for a lot of Black UUs, it's why we left congregations that we're no longer a part of, because we were not feeling as though our whole selves were welcome, were that our spiritual growth as Black people was being fostered in that environment. And so it's really important that we continue to make that point and drive it home and help make sure people know how important that is.
I noticed Standing on the Side of Love issued guidelines today, suggestions of what to do if your sign is defaced. And I thought, I've never seen that. We've had many, including Joanna's rainbow flags, have been taken, vandalized over the years, but not in such, I mean, they've disappeared. Nobody has burned them or slashed them, or many, many of them have been stolen over the years. But that was I was like, wow, we need, I mean, they're good guidelines. I commend them to people. They're Standing on the Side of Love, but we've never needed that. And yeah, that's what I think that anti-blackness tide is a good description of how it feels.
Yeah. I think too, you know, in thinking about Marlon's sermon at General Assembly, where he said that, you know, he reminded us that we talking about having a diversity of theologies, you know, that we always like to promote the fact we have a diversity of theologies in our congregations. However, we don't actually spend that much time actually speaking to each other about our beliefs. And you know, and I wonder if you know, white Unitarian Universalists or any Unitarian Universalist, hearing one subject all the time, if that seems really too much. You know, if people have gotten very used to having a very broad description of our faith, theologically or otherwise, if all of a sudden people are going, we need to go deep on this issue, we need to have conversations about this issue, we need to go deep on this, that it's really challenging for folks to really, who've gotten used to, you know, that they came to the church for a reason very different from the person who perhaps is sitting at the other end of the pew from them. And for us to sort of say, there is all this diversity here, but here's a time for us to go deep. And I wonder how much of the of pushback in our congregations also, you know, comes from that, comes from that issue as well.
But for some people, it's an issue. For other people, it's life. I mean, I think, you know, it's like to say, like, well, we're going to care about these people today, but that's enough of that. Let's care about other people tomorrow. I mean, I hear what you're saying. That is, I think, an unfortunate aspect of our faith, is that everything seems optional, you know. And I've heard people say that. I've heard people say what you just said, as if it is a reason to back away from people who we're with. A lot of people are coming to CLF right now. A lot of people of color are coming to CLF because it's too painful to be in their church. And we're trying to create some spaces for Black people, for people of color, to be with one another, I think, because I have white skin. I walk around with it all the time, and I have a kid who is not white. And so I kind of see very personally what it means when a human being becomes an issue. And so I just want to name that. Aisha, were you coming in to say something?
Well, I think part of what happens and what I experience happening also as a religious educator is when we talk about we are so inclusive. And I always ask, well, who are we talking about? There's a thread on the religious educator Facebook page that's closed about youth cons. And kind of, you know, somebody lifted up that they're not actually as great as everyone says they are. And I just said, well, how welcoming are youth cons to youth of color? And that question kind of kept getting lost, because it's like, no, we're so radically inclusive. And I said, if we're going to make statements like we're radically inclusive, that has to be true for other than just one group of people who feel marginalized. It has to also include youth of color. Otherwise, we really don't have the right to use that term. And I think that's, to me, I always ask, when we say we're inclusive, I think we're always really, you know, when people do welcoming congregation, and that whole thing makes me crazy, because so you've checked off a box 5 years ago that you accept the LGBTQ community, and then what? how about everything else? So I think it's when we use inclusion, we think we've covered it. And we genuinely believe, as you use, that we're inclusive. And I think we're woefully opposite of that when it comes to race and ethnic diversity.
Well, and we really like, you know, there are so many people who come to our churches and they say, oh, I can feel safe here. I can feel comfort here. I can feel comfortable here. Okay, well, what does it mean if for someone else in the church to feel safe and to feel comfortable, it means that you may be pushed out of that? You know, why does it all have to be this one definition of what comfortable is? And don't even get me started on whether that's why you should go to church anyway.
I think one of the things that came out of our multiple discussions at the convening as Black UUs was this notion that our congregations, brick and mortar congregations, are on the one hand fostering of comfort and safety for white UUs, and on the other hand putting Black UUs in a position to feel the exact opposite of that. And so when we talk about addressing anti-Blackness in our faith, that's at the heart of it. It's at the heart of what does it mean to be a comfortable space for people of color and for UUs of color. And so it's a real big duality, and it's very harmful to us as we affirm the beliefs and our seven principles and believe ourselves to be Unitarian Universalists. However, when it comes to affirming our faith as Black people, we're not welcomed and we're not supported in doing that. And so that is a real other point that the Black Lives of UU is going to hope to give voice to and give context to. And so we started with these principles as a way of allowing folks to connect our fight for Black liberation as Black people to our faith as Unitarian Universalists. And then moving from here, you're going to see a lot more challenging statements and a lot more challenging actions in terms of what does it mean for Black UUs to feel comfortable in their own skin in our faith, and what does that look like? How can that transform our ideas as what Unitarian Universalists are? So I'd mention that as well. It was a big, big topic of conversation at the convening amongst all of us.
And to build on what Leslie was saying, I think what the point that Hank is getting to is we're just starting to see, we're just beginning to see like what the full implications of that is going to be. I mean, I keep reminding people again, you know, just for historical context, if we think about the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church in America, both got started in the early 19th century when women couldn't vote, when most Black people in the United States were slaves. You know, all of that was still the case. So there's ways in which this institution, which was established, you know, many generations ago, was not even designed to support and affirm and promote the lives of, you know, most of the people who are part of it, you know, to this day. So I think that, you know, to the extent that, you know, our, you know, larger Unitarian Universalist membership, especially those who identify as white, I think what this is an opportunity to is to reimagine and reinvent and reconceive what Unitarian Universalism can be in the 21st century, acknowledging that, yes, that we're going to need to look at things a bit differently, and that includes, in part, creating spaces where Black people who identify as Black are able to come together and be in conversation with one another. And I know we've already seen some reactivity around that, including from Black Unitarian Universalists who see it as like, oh, we're going back to segregation, and what is this? And to them, I would say, if we could hold it in the context of pastoral care, and acknowledge that we're not, you know, even though we're all sitting in these pews at the same time, we're not all having the same experience. And especially by the time we leave these pews, we're not all going to be having the same experience when we step out on the street. We don't have the same relationship to law enforcement. You know, so all of that needs to be acknowledged and lifted up. And yes, I'd say, you know, let's get ready for the gift of discomfort. And spread the anxiety. That's what we're saying. We're feeling it all the time. It's like but now you try it on. See how you like it.
Carlton and Leslie, I have a question. I've spoken with Sean Dennison about the dynamic that he sees of about being transgender within Unitarian Universalism, and how there starts to be this categorization from outside the transgender community about the good transgender people and the bad transgender people. And it all seems to be rooted in who makes the UUs, the non-trans UUs, uncomfortable, right? That's is that a dynamic that you see?
I would say definitely. I think I like to refer to it as the racial justice UU circuit, as I refer to it, you know, where we see the same voices, the same faces lifted up and not necessarily those that I would call on in terms of the radicalization of our faith and what that question ponders. I think that those of us that may be a little more on the radical side, you know, I for me, like I started this journey of Black Lives UU and putting these principles together with no idea what the end will be. And for me, it's really important for everybody to note that, just speaking for myself, I can't speak for everybody, but for me, the end result might be me not being a Unitarian Universalist in the way that I am, that I consider myself today. I don't know if that's going to happen, but this is meant to challenge both myself as a Unitarian Universalist and our faith to see if it is the right one for me as a Black person. And so this is an opportunity for all of us to enter in a conversation and see if this is a place that Black people can feel lifted up and supported and allowed to be our full selves. And so I'm hopeful that we can have these conversations and move forward in a way that works. But I also am cognizant that sometimes that's not always going to be possible, and that we are facing a level of anti-Blackness at an institutional level, not just in our country, but in our faith that has never been confronted before. And so I like to see this process as almost a microcosm of what the Movement for Black Lives is trying to do in our wider society as Americans, and certainly in a global level as well. And so when we confront things like the fact that we don't have African proverbs and hymns in our books and scriptures, you know, we say we're an inclusive faith, but what does that really look like when you're a Black person? And so a lot of that we see in terms of the voices that our faith chooses to lift up. They lift up voices that are placating to whiteness, that are centered in whiteness, that allow whiteness to feel comforted and okay with the stance that they take. And I would say less challenging voices. And so, yeah, I definitely see that as well.
Yeah, I would certainly affirm what Leslie just said. And it's just for an example, you know, some of the ways that it plays out, even if we're taking something like General Assembly, for example, where there is intention to have representation of different voices present, and that can be acknowledged and affirmed on one hand, and then, you know, if you actually listen to what's coming from, you know, some of those voices, you might come to the conclusion that some folks are chosen based on their notoriety rather than whether or not they actually have like something new and something very progressive to share with, you know, the larger, with the group. And to Leslie's point, even if it is, you know, a black person who's speaking, that person is going to, if you're standing on the stage at General Assembly and looking out, whatever you say is going to be addressed to appeal and to the masses. And if you look out at that, it's not, you're not, that person isn't going to be talking to Black people as such. Even though they might be Black themselves, it's going to be something that is going to, you know, work for the audience that hired them in some cases to come in and speak. And so you're going to be meeting those expectations and needs rather than what might actually be the needs of the Black people in the room. So it's a fascinating dynamic.
It is a tricky dynamic. I was, you know, doing the advocacy and witness when Bill Sinkford was the president, and there were times when he would say, I can't do this because I'm Black. A white president could do this. If I do it, it will be seen as divisive. And that was, you know, that was real, and it was hard.
Yeah,
it was just
absolutely.
It was just part of what was going on. Yeah. So I think this collective thing that you're doing is a radical thing in Unitarian Universalism, period, about anything. But, you know, because it's such an individualistic you know, I statements, never we statements. And I'm curious, when you were doing the principles as a collective, how that shifted it from if you'd each just sat and written, you know, a personal statement.
I think because we took them directly from the convening and the principles that we gathered together with in Cleveland, that it really was a we document that we started with and took from, and it was a we feeling that we brought with us back home after the convening. And so having that as the emotional center of the work really allowed us to not have any qualms with saying we or having it be a we. Too often Black people are asked to do one of two things. One, speak for all of Blackdom. And two, ensure that we're not connected as Blackdom. So I think that the convening allowed two things. One is the acknowledgement that we are not a monolith. We are individuals, and we need to relish in that. But on the other hand, that we also need to be given space to be a collective, to gather together, to heal together, to address things that only we understand and we can come together to discuss. And so for me, it wasn't a difficult transition. I think that, you know, those of us that were at the convening and so many Black folks that weren't able to be there, but, you know, saw what was going on and heard from all of us that were there, the feeling of it, you know, I liken it to quenching a thirst I didn't have. This pull of building a space of Blackness and what that felt like and what it looked like and what shape it took, you know, being on the planning committee and one of the convening coordinators, you know, we had hopes, and I personally had an idea as to what it would look and feel like, but being in it, it was completely, it was beyond anything I could have imagined. And so I think that helped us be able to ground it in that collective spirit.
That's fabulous. And I realize as we come up to the end that, Carlton, you never told the story about Alondria and the police and everything. Do you want to, because that seemed like to me indicative of the world we're looking for here. Do you want to maybe close this out with that story?
Yeah. It was the closing circle had already happened. A number of us, including myself, had already left to catch flights at the airport. When out on the street, there was a young 14-year-old Black boy who was being taken into police custody, apparently for public drunkenness. And it was at that, and the group that was gathered or still remained saw this happening and saw them trying to put him into the wagon to take him off. And encircled the wagon and started to chant, would not let him take him. And so Alondria entered into that space and started negotiating with the police. There was a point at which, Leslie might know more of the sequence than I do, but one of the police officers started to pepper spray the people who were preventing the police from leaving with this young person. But I saw some of the video footage of it, and to see like Alondria standing in the midst of those police officers, you know, negotiating with them hard, you know, to you know, bring peace to the situation, bring a peaceful resolution, was amazing. And through the chanting, through the resistance, they were able to, the group was able to see that young boy was returned to the custody of his mother rather than being taken off by the police. And I thought that was just fantastic and amazing, and just it inspired me that much more. Leslie.
Yeah, I mean, you described it quite well, and Alondria and the rest of the safety team were integral in kind of entering those spaces, and they were trained. They had different color shirts on, so we knew when anything happened that was a safety concern, whether it was, you know, internal or external, that these were the people we called, and Alondria led that team amazingly well throughout the entire weekend and had called to be interceding in several different occasions, this obviously being the most dramatic and most large you know, forward-facing action. And it was a very impromptu, you know, people were heading back to their dorm rooms to pack up and leave and saw this situation happening. The pepper spray happened very quickly. As soon as the police saw that there was a large contingent of Black folks, they started, one of the leading officers just started aberrantly spraying pepper spray on people. And when I tell you that the collective movement is so alive. I mean, this was 1,500 people who have been involved in the movement and have done actions all over the country, but within 15, you know, not even 10 or 15 minutes, we had a safety team already there interacting with the police, getting, we had jail support, writing numbers on people's arms to ensure that we had lawyers on the space. We had people that had went and got milk so that there was triage and treatment for those who had been pepper sprayed. This all happened in concert. Nobody discussed it. We had several mic checks. We had spaces that were being created so that we were blocking but still allowing passage for the mother to come in and speak with her son, and for the young boy to be treated as well by paramedics before they were let out. So it was a really large collective action. And again, pretty seamlessly occurred. It was really impressive for me just to see all the work organizing that has been going on throughout the country come together in this one, you know, pinpointed spot and play itself out in that way. So I would say that it was really amazing to see, and we were, of course, overjoyed that we were able to stop that particular detaining of this this young man and have him released to the custody of his mother.
And he was a part of the group.
No, he just was
Landian,
yes, that we intervened with.
Well, thank you for leaving me with tears in my eyes. That is a beautiful story. And Alondra Williams, for those of you who don't know her, lifelong UU and still at the Highlander Center, as far as I know.
Yep.
Is that true? Yeah. On the Presidential Search Committee with Joanna. So it's great. Our hour's up. I'm really excited. You'll be back in a month, and different members of the collective may come through. And I thank you so much for being here. Thanks to everybody who came live and who listens to this on podcast. And we'll see you next time.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.